right, so we are officially in the last weekend of pool play for the Springboks, at least, at this World Cup. And it's a surprisingly more nervy assignment than it should have been against Tonga and Marseille this weekend. Welcome to the Inside Pass, News 24's daily Rugby World Cup podcast. My name is Hein Schenk, and with me again is Simne Kiwet-Kabanisa. And we'll also have our man on the ground in Toulon, Kaniso Troka, with us on the line in a few moments to discuss the happenings in the Bok camp, as well as what might actually transpire this weekend. But firstly, Sim, except for the fact that there's still the elephant in the room that is Andre Pollard, you had an interesting chat this morning with former Springbok defence coach John McFarland, who worked under Heineke Meyer, obviously, at the national team and at the Bulls. And they had a certain man named Derek Keane, who was actually morphed from a flanker to a very accomplished and dependable hooker. Could you perhaps give us a bit of insight on what was the chat, you know, with the old guy?
I probably should also start by, you know, making the public service announcement to anyone who didn't enjoy listening to this that don't worry, we're being evicted as of this, you know, today. This is our last day. We don't know if we'll ever come back again, you know, if they'll have us. But, yeah, we enjoyed it while it lasted.
Yeah, apologies if we've been a bit bohemian this week from our esteemed colleagues in Cape Town. It has indeed been fun, yeah.
But so my chat with John McFarland was basically about converting players, usually flankers, interestingly enough, into hookers, and basically, you know, what goes into that from a technical perspective, and over and above that, you know, how much risk as a result the Boks are taking in converting Dion Fury. And, well, I suppose Dion Fury is this kind of like a weird sort of come full circle, because he started out as a hooker, went to open side flank, and now he's back as a hooker. And then obviously Marco van Staden, who's being properly converted into a hooker. And obviously the hook being the fact that we're playing both in the match day 23 against Tonga. So it was, you mentioned Derek Keane. I must mention a few more for you.
Sure.
That they actually converted as a tag team. Gary Buerta.
Mm-hmm.
Tommy Youngs.
Mm-hmm.
Oka Marks.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think. There's one other that I've forgotten, but it's that many. And basically, these guys almost went around, you know. I suspect, Heinz, if they'd run into you in your younger days, it would be like, he'd make a good hooker. Yeah, yeah, come on, son, let's do this. They kind of like went around, you know, sort of almost converting half the rugby world into hookers. But anyway, they got it right. So the really cool thing about the discussion is, you know, he says, well, the interesting thing to come out of the discussion is that he says, it is a risk that the Boks are doing it, simply because it takes probably about 2 years to bed it down. You know, this is obviously it's the throwing, and the throwing itself is like there's a variety of throws in terms of how you throw. It's not like using a Mick and Drick camera where you basically just point and shoot. No, there's an awful lot that's going on, because guys, you know, are moving around. So there's a lot. Essentially throwing to moving parts. Obviously, the scrummaging is probably one of the more difficult things, because where maybe in the old days where Derek Keane might have started as a hooker, I think back then you got, you know, like a free kick for almost everything. But now DC says scrums are basically a clear point of advantage where you can try and have a go at the opposition, and therefore looking for penalties, which basically means you can't basically be carried on an armchair ride by your props. It's literally a situation where you do have to actually get in, you know, roll up your sleeves as well, know what you're doing in terms of scrummaging. So he says, yeah, it's quite a risk, simply because it takes time. And I mean, I know that Dion started working at being a hooker again, you know, on his throwing, let me put it that way, last year. That's what Rita Klingwane told me. And then I think Eskom only started in February. So obviously there's not enough time, but now they're doing it at World Cup level, which basically, you know, raises question marks about what happens in the in the all important sort of knockout games, you know, last 5 minutes. And if we're being fair, you saw in the last 5 minutes of the game against Ireland where, you know, Dion had to throw and in his case he's actually been a hooker, so it's not like, you know, you're talking
unfamiliar with it.
Yeah, you're not talking a guy who's almost starting cold as Eskom is. You know, he, you know, there was the one he didn't throw in straight, and I would say even the one he did throw in for that sort of messy rolling maul that, you know, the ref gave what we felt was the wrong call on. You know, even that, it was kind of like floated to the point where they couldn't set up the maul properly. And so as a result, the maul was quite messy as opposed to tight. So it can, you know, it's just one thing to practice it in practice. And even if it's a live line out, it's actually quite tricky to do it when it matters. And that's when you know that you can. But there's only one way of knowing. It's when you've got that last 5 minutes and you're either going to get it right or you're going to get it wrong. So, yeah, fascinating chat. I still have to, you know, sit and write the story. But very fascinating in terms of what we're doing with, you know, with this experiment.
I'm definitely looking forward to it. So, inevitably, the other big discussion point invariably is Hanred Pollard. But we actually have Kaniso Tshaku on the line. And we understand that finally, for a man who's dominated the Springbok discourse for the last 3 weeks, he finally actually chatted to the media today at the top table. Trux, welcome back. It's nice having you here. Can you perhaps tell us a bit what our anointed pivot actually told everyone?
Anointed pivot. Good morning, gentlemen. Good morning to the listeners. Look, the stock standard stuff that he was very happy to be back. He's been working hard. Injuries have been frustrating, but look, it's the long and the short of it is that he's very happy to be back with the team. Look, I mean, he's been talked up in terms of the work that he's going to put in, what he's been learning from the team itself. He also actually spoke well about how Moni is looked after in Team McKay perspective, and he will still do what he needs to do to get his kicking stuff done. So look, I mean, we weren't expecting anything different from Andre Pollard, but it's very clear that he's keen to get out on the field and play on Sunday.
Trux, I know it's difficult to actually gauge what the plan might be, you know, based on just one open training session like you guys had. It was actually astounding. I saw that you reported 7,000 people actually came to Stadmajor to actually check out the guys and stuff. Was there anything interesting that you picked up in terms of plays from, you know, from halfback to pivot to perhaps, you know, what Andre Esterhazen and Kanan Moody and those guys will do? I suppose we probably should be looking forward to almost like a throwback to 2019, perhaps at stages in this game on Sunday.
Look, I think what the Bucks needed to do yesterday was to not show their full hand, understandably so.
Yeah.
It being an open training session, they wouldn't know who's there to watch, who's there to pick up something and stuff like that. So I think what they always did was that they showed fans what they've seen over the past few weeks. If there were intricate details that they had, they would have probably ran through them on Tuesday and Wednesday. And then at yesterday's session, they effectively showed fans that, yeah, here the box, this is how we play our rugby. But in terms of actually the trade secrets, they actually kept them on the low yesterday.
Trux, is Eskom throwing straight?
He is. So is Dion. I mean, that makes a very good point that Dion is actually throwing. I remember in the Mbombela, ahead of the Mbombela test against New Zealand, where what he was doing was that he actually did a lot of throwing before the game in the respective training session. So it's been something that he's been doing. To be fair, Marco did remain a surprise from a throwing perspective, but I think the two hookers have been doing a lot of throwing. He's been doing a lot of throwing with them. So what they have done is that they've been working on that particular skill. But as Sim and John McFarlane rightly say, it's one thing doing it in practice, then you still have to execute in a match.
Chuck, I'm a big believer in, you know, if your throwing is going to be a surprise, you know, for obviously your teammates, it's probably going to be a surprise for the opposition as well.
True, but also on the other hand, opposition will know that have you been tested in the pressure cooker of a lost of a throw 2 minutes left in the game? You need to maul it up. Is that throw straight? Because I watched on TSA Analytics on YouTube when I actually recap the game where that particular person always trying to pick out performance. I mean, one of the things that he said was the first thing about the Dion Fouris throw and it wasn't straight. But because Beno Kitipa was looking at so many things in that game, he missed out on the skew throw, he missed out on so many other infringements at that particular moment. But the first thing he picked up was that throw wasn't straight. And I think in a quarterfinal where you are trading 13-12 and you're needing to score, the last thing you want from your hook is a skew throw in the 79th minute where you need to mold the ball up to get an advantage and score. So one would hope that pieces are ironed out this week, and hopefully they won't actually raise the ugly head again over the weekend.
Trux, before we let you go, it almost felt like it crept up to us when we saw your diary item this morning before the news meeting. Siya Kolisi playing his 50th test match as captain. Just a word of how you guys have experienced sort of like that, almost I want to say low-key build-up, you know, to one of the dominant themes actually of this game.
Well, he even said at the press conference he didn't know until the team was announced. So that's how low-key it was for him, that the key for him is just that he needs to get the team wins, make sure that he plays well. So the fact that he didn't know, I think speaks volumes to the fact that for Sia, it's all about the team and less about what the other, and less about him and what the job means for him. Because at the end of the day, he speaks about the fact that he is part of the team. He's just elected as captain, but he's part of the team and his leadership means nothing without the team. And I think that effectively sums up Siya Kolisi in particular, because he's always put the team first above all else. And he says that he can't be the embodiment of leadership because once he's off the captaincy, he still remains Siya Kolisi.
Trux, thanks very much for your time. I really appreciate it. Go well. And we'll chat to you again.
No, thank you very much, guys.
Sim, just on Sia again. It sort of like just fits into the whole Sia legend as a leader, actually, just what Trox said. But has it also like felt to you that, gosh, this milestone is just like very, very steadily crept up to us and boom, here it is.
Yeah, it probably did sort of sneak up on us. I mean, when we saw the information this morning, it was just like, what, already? You know, it almost feels like, you know, it hasn't been. I mean, it makes absolute sense if you just count the years, you know, 2018 until now, surely, you know, he would have been, you know, whenever he played, he was captain. So that kind of makes sense. But look, I'm sort of more, I know he sounds like he sought to play, you know, to play the whole thing down, as an achievement, and then B, maybe, you know, the place it affords him in the team. But, you know, we all know that being captain of the Springbok team is not like being captain of any other national team in the world. That's the first thing. And then when you add the fact that, you know, he's a black guy doing it, that makes it even more significant, because we know the politics of our country and we know the politics of our rugby. And for him to not only have, I mean, I remember when he was named as captain, as if it was yesterday. You know, at the time, obviously, it was a risky call, because if we remember right, you know, before that, Alistair Couture had an opportunity to name him captain, and he basically didn't take it because he kind of felt, you know, he should protect him, you know, from obviously, you know, whatever could be, you know, the fallout. He basically felt he wasn't ready. And he went with Evan Etzebeth. I remember at the time being very critical of Alistair and kind of saying, well, it's just a typical situation of, you know, us older black guys who kind of like have maybe been insecure in these spaces. And by these spaces, I mean in rugby and whatnot, you know, kind of like, you know, revisiting our sort of insecurities or low self-esteem within the game onto sort of our kids, if you want to put it that way. And that was my take at the time. But, you know, when you look at that year, the Bucks shipped 50 points under Ibn Etzebeth. And I always ask the question to anyone.
And a record defeat to Ireland as well.
Exactly. I always ask, you know, would see the rugby player, let alone the, you know, the captain have survived, would his career have survived those defeats? And the simple answer is probably not. I don't know for sure. But so, you know, probably, you know, there is such a thing as right place and right time. And it seems to have been 2018 rather than, you know, 2016, 17 or whatever it was, more probably 2017 more like. So, I mean, if you look back then again at the guy who started the job, you know, that whole sort of captaincy by, you know, by diplomacy, you know, trying to get everyone on board to the guy you now see. You know, you now see a guy who's basically, you know, very much the guy in charge, regardless of how sort of democratic he's being with the leadership. Just the sheer level of growth. It's been quite interesting with Sia, sort of the more elevated the moment has become, or the circumstances, the better he's become. That's both as a player and as a leader. And, you know, he's done nothing but grow over that period. If you look at, you know, you look at his communication, and you look at his empathy for his team. I mean, and that's what I like about him. You know, he's one of those guys, and people think this is easy. He's one of those guys that's exactly the same with people from all walks of life. You know, he meets a person from the street, he treats him exactly the same as he would if, you know, if he met the president of the country. And I find that, you know, like you think that's not a big thing. It's a massive thing. And that's the kind of guy he's been. You know, I mean, I'm in my 40s now. I'm not afraid to say, even, you know, a guy his age is probably 32 now.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't, you know, as a person in my field of work, I definitely look up to him. And so that's how sort of that's a kind of, you know, respect I hold, you know, that's a level of respect I hold him in. And actually, he's been so much better as a rugby player as well. I think a lot of people don't, you know, a lot of people want to get caught up with the, you know, the sideshow stuff of the leadership. But, you know, as a player, he's just steadily kept improving. And, you know, at the beginning, we talked about how he couldn't jackal. He can jackal now with the best of them. And he does so much for the team, and he does it also selflessly. You know, most captains would whinge about being taken off at the 50th minute or whatever it is. He takes it because he sees himself as a squad member, and all that matters is, you know, what the team can do. And there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot we can sort of pick up from looking at him. And I think the greatest thing is he hasn't changed from, you know, the guy he was before he was captain. I'm sure he's made loads of money. He's got loads of very important contacts in his phone book, but he's still exactly the same person that, you know, I remember meeting all those years ago. You know, he's still a compulsive hugger. He still is very respectful to people he considers his elders, and so on and so on. I've got nothing but time for him, as you can tell.
100% agree with you. I just find him so eloquent nowadays also, and just whatever he deals with. I remember just before the Twickenham test, I asked him specifically, because this was sort of like a commercial arrangement in many ways. It was a way for for Rugby New Zealand and for SAR to actually get some test match revenue coming in from a season where they basically only had two home tests.
Yeah,
and given the fact that he operated in a distinctly more commercialized environment at the Sharks since MVM came on board, and that he was their poster boy by all accounts, and just asking him about what the economics of this actually might represent in a very basic level, he was just so brilliant. You know, so whether it's societal issues, whether it's like interpersonal relationship, whether it's technical questions, whether it's, you know, economics, finances, you know, this guy is just absolutely amazing to me as well. And I also appreciate actually what he said to Trucks and the media contingent is exactly how it actually is. I think really he understands the magnitude of his role. But I also think, like, you can absolutely bank on him being right in the moment on Sunday, being the guy who calms things down, who gives direction, because in the end, it's all about just gaining 5 match points from that game.
Yeah.
And I think he's going to drive them all the way to it. You know, I love the simplicity of it. Yeah.
And like you said yesterday, you know, the point of having him in a team with that sort of many little changes and little experiments here and there, the point is to make sure that, you know, the guys are still flying in formation as opposed to kind of like the changes take over and they start pulling in different directions. And that's exactly it. And it speaks volumes that he's seen as that guy, you know, because they're not short of guys with experience, but he's seen as the guy that can kind of like have the end goal in mind, if you want to call it that, or the bigger picture in mind in terms of what do we need to do as a combination, instead of, you know, what do we need to do, what do these guys need to do to advance their sort of individual claims, if you want to call it that.
So briefly, let's just broaden our scope quickly. For a change, exactly. It feels like we've just been talking Springboks, which is understandable. But anyway, we do have a broader interest in the game. So interesting this weekend. I suppose for some teams it might be a moving weekend, but actually I just see this weekend as one where if you're playing Super Brew, you might actually get 8 out of 8. There's not exactly like a game where you think, I don't know which way this is going to go. But an important weekend in terms of Pool B for South Africa, it's the Scotland-Romania result. Specifically, I think the points difference might be a problem. And then, of course, Fiji have a golden opportunity, I think, to sew up a spot in the quarterfinals again against Georgia.
Yeah, quite interesting for me.
And let's not forget, perhaps, the All Blacks in Italy, although I don't hold out much hope, but yeah, we can talk about that as well.
Yeah, I've been cracking stupid jokes all week about how Italy could, you know, upset the All Blacks. I've seen the team the All Blacks have chosen. It's probably the nearest thing to their best team. Not going to happen. Yes, I think, you know, Italy will give the All Blacks to hurry up for maybe a good 55, maximum 60 minutes. But then afterwards, you know, the class of the All Blacks will tell. Doesn't matter that they maybe don't quite have the forwards, you know, to say play against the box or whatever it is. At the end of the day, you know, they still the All Blacks.
Exactly.
It's still kind of like, you know, at some level, they still sort of the standard bearer of the game. I mean, I know they've got their struggles and they've had their struggles in recent years, but I fully expect them to be back almost where they belong, what, probably next year or whatever it is. But I'm just looking at the other games. Obviously there's this whole Fiji Georgia thing. Georgia's been slightly underwhelming. I was very surprised that they pack, you know, they're the one strength that, you know, they supposedly have. Was handled by the Aussies, you know, who don't have a tradition or a history of a strong pack. And so as a result, it kind of gives, you know, this new age Fijians, you know, who actually do quite a fair bit in the tight exchanges these days, instead of, you know, just hoping that, you know, they get the ball and they run rings around you. Yeah, that is probably actually the one game where you could get an upset if maybe the Georgian forwards get on top and then basically just starve those guys off ball and defend well. But I don't know, I just don't see a situation that this current Fijian team is so well drilled and such a good team, you know, not just a batch of individuals thrown together, that you actually, I won't lie, I wouldn't be surprised if they handled whatever Georgia threw at them. And basically, you know, snuffed out Australia's chances of making it into the quarters. So I expect this to be the weekend that the Aussies, you know, are finally, you know, basically out of the competition.
But just one of the interesting themes, just quickly, to emerge from Fiji specifically, is that they've actually shown the way, ironically, how the Samoans and the Tongans. I'm still not convinced that the Tongans will actually like mount a decisive challenge against the Springboks. I just can't see it happening. But what Fiji have shown is that cohesion and continuity, because I think they have something like 19 of the the Super Rugby Drua squad, you know, in the national squad now as well. It just shows you that continuity is far more important than actually throwing in a Lialifano. I know Izzy Folau is injured now, but just like plucking him in there and dropping in Malachi Fikitoa and all those guys, that the bullishness of the Pacific Islanders, it seems, were actually a bit misguided, you know, is that they neglected, you know, the one of the essential and basic principles thing, of, you know,
of team, rugby in particular.
Team management,
Look, at that's always been the beauty of rugby. And in a strange way, that's why I've always been grateful to have played rugby at school or to have played rugby at all, I guess, is that, you know, it teaches you about the value of you have a role to play sort of in the context of others around you. You know, it, you know, if you play sort of individual sports, and maybe even cricket can do that to you sometimes, where you kind of like you sit and you think, well, it's just me and the batsman, or vice versa. You can get caught up in that. But like in rugby, if you don't play your part, chances are, or maybe if like two or three of you don't play your part in 15, chances are the whole thing comes crashing down. So it doesn't matter how many of you there are, you still need to play your part and stay in that particular lane for the whole sort of collective to be able to work. So obviously these guys have recognized that, and they've decided to use it, whereas maybe the Tongans didn't. They just thought, if you just bring our heavy hitters, you know, heavy hitters sometimes can destroy a team because, you know, everyone wants to pull in their own different direction, which is, you know, which is a pity for those guys. But I think that the more important thing is those guys need more rugby with teams that kind of like, you know, you can play super rugby with like, you know, maybe the second tier of Tongans or, you know, even though it's sort of picked together as a national team, you can still do that. And so on and so on. Or you can play, I don't know, you can play URC as whatever. Look, I'm obviously introducing new problems, you know, to existing structures. But I'm just saying those tier two teams need more rugby, not less. And, you know, I was speaking to John O'Farland earlier, and he says, you know, they went to Tonga with Canada because that's who he's with now. And they went, you know, played Fiji as well. And that's the thing, you know, we actually need to go to those areas, you know, turn up as the Springboks and basically play against them, not just to go to Twickenham because you know there's a pot of gold in those tickets that you're going to be able to sell there because you're playing as the All Blacks. You know, that's kind of like, you know, if we want to grow the game, that's what we need to start doing. And remember, you know, you may look at Fiji as a small rugby country simply because of just numbers. But in terms of rugby being the very first, you know, the first and probably only sport there.
Exactly.
You know, you taking it to rugby country, if you want to call it that. Sometimes I think we get a bit muddled up in sort of like the grading of, you know, who should you and who should you not go to. I mean, going to Fiji has to be an incredibly cultural exercise for a rugby team simply because, well, we've seen what they can do.
Exactly. 100% agree with you. Sim, as always, a pleasure.
All good, man. We're done now.
I hope you have a good rugby weekend.
Yeah, it should be all right.
And listeners, thank you for putting up with us too. It has been a privilege, although I think we're a bit more, perhaps more maverick than our more methodical, you know, colleagues, esteemed colleagues. But it really has been fun. And we hope to meet up again next week. Thanks for tuning in.